This is Gabfest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political Gabfest, an explosion on the right as House Majority Leader Eric Cantor loses his primary to a Tea Party unknown. Also, is tenure for public school teachers an abomination? A California judge thinks so. I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture Gabfest, could a resurrection of home ec classes make for better relationships? Then, we debate whether adults should be embarrassed about reading young adult books. And then the film Obvious Child, a rom-com that's radically blasé about abortion.
Oh, my God. You didn't use a condom? I remember seeing a condom. I just don't know, like, exactly what it did.
We'll start with the Political Gabfest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington. In one of the most shocking defeats in recent political history, House Majority Leader Eric Cantor lost his primary Tuesday to Tea Partier David Brat. Cantor was upended for his stance on immigration, his ties to Wall Street and corporate America, his detachment from his district, and his willingness to compromise occasionally with Democrats. Washington's already broken, but could Cantor's defeat somehow make it worse? And a California judge declares tenure provisions for public school teachers in that state unconstitutional. Is teacher tenure a prime cause of low-performing schools? Why has the Obama administration joined the crusade against it? I'm joined by phone from Iowa by Slate's chief political correspondent, John Dickerson. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
And from New Haven, Slate senior editor Emily Bazelon. Hi, Emily.
Hey, David.
Eric Cantor, the second-ranked Republican in the House, the majority leader, the heir apparent to House Speaker John Boehner, lost his primary on Tuesday in one of the most shocking congressional defeats I can remember. The Virginian was defeated by a little-known, or perhaps better to say unknown, Tea Party-backed candidate, an economics professor at a small college in Virginia named David Brat. And Brat had inveighed against Cantor's ties to Wall Street, his disconnection from the people of his district, and Cantor's support for immigration reform. It's essentially certain that whoever succeeds Cantor in the position of majority leader for the Republicans will be more conservative than he is, though he himself was pretty darn conservative. There's also some chance, John will tell us how much of a chance, that Boehner himself will be toppled by an internal revolt. So, John, why did Cantor lose? How much does it matter?
You'll promise you'll get back to those two other questions.
Yes.
We promise.
This is the most pressing one. Why did he lose? Well, it's a multifaceted answer. One, he was out raising a lot of money for his party and other members of the Republican Conference. So he was in Beverly Hills a lot and places like that where they can raise lots of money, but not spending enough time defending his home turf. The other thing is that, as one Republican strategist put it, the campaign was basically like political malpractice. I mean, so not only was he not defending his home turf and taking it as seriously as he should have, but he ran lots, and he outspent his opponent 40-1, ran lots and lots of negative ads, which were so over the top and blunt and sort of unbelievable, calling Brat a liberal professor, which was just basically hacky attacks, that it ended up elevating and popularizing Brat, so it raised his name ID for a guy who had very little money. And then on the question of immigration, not only is immigration a hot-button issue, and so one that grassroots Republican voters really care about, but on that hot-button issue, Cantor kind of tried to play it both ways, and so was demonstrating the kind of lack of principle and fixity that drives grassroots Republican voters nuts. And his pollster said he was up by 30 points, a nearly 45-point mistake. So there were a lot of reasons that for why this didn't work.
So Will Salatin, our colleague, wrote an interesting piece saying what's striking about the primary voters in this district is that they are much whiter, much older, and much more conservative than even Republicans as a whole.
Right. I mean, it does seem like the composition of the district mattered, that the people who wanted to throw Eric Cantor out in a kind of throw out the bums way are people who are in that category of feeling dispossessed and frustrated with Washington. And it seemed like they were reflecting a strain of populism that you know, obviously we associate with the Tea Party. And this was a reminder to me of how the business interests of the Republican Party and the popular interests can diverge. So, you know, Cantor's position on immigration is what the U.S. Chamber of Commerce wants him to be saying. In fact, he's probably to the left of where the chamber is. Yet that didn't matter because the people who see him as failing them and as sort of cheating and hedging and, you know, not answering questions directly on Fox, I read that somewhere today, those people don't care about the chamber. They see the chamber also as an entrenched interest. So it's, I think, you know, he couldn't straddle that line somehow all of a sudden.
Emily, one thing I'm hugely worried about is that when you take a scalp like Cantor's, it sends the signal to the Republicans that we've already gotten it pretty strongly already, that any form of compromise, any vote to raise the debt ceiling, to do a budget deal with the president, is a form of capitulation, and therefore you can't do it. We've skirted so close to default in this country. We already had a government shutdown. We came very close to default a couple of times and only saved kind of by desperate measures by Cantor and Boehner and a very few other Republican congressmen. And now Cantor's gone, and also that leadership position will be gone for compromise.
You know,
interrupt me in 1 second, John, but are we at a point, John, if you want to answer this, where that kind of margin of error for something like a default is gone?
No, because Kevin McCarthy's likely to get Cantor's position. He's not that much farther the right. He's basically Cantor. So the problem with the idea that this is going to, like, take over the entire Republican leadership is that there aren't the votes for some candidate. I mean, Jeb Hensarling, who would have been the favorite of the kind of grassroots activist movement, would have been like Mike Pence or like Chadig, two previous conservative favorites who never got more than like 50 to 60 votes. And that's why Boehner's not really threatened, because there's not somebody to run against him. So the leadership of the House will still largely be where it was. One other thing I would add is, if the Republicans take control of the Senate, and there is a greater than 50% chance that they will, then you have a Republican Party that controls both houses of Congress. They're going to have to govern. They're going to have to pass laws and put them on the president's desk. And you're going to have to get people to compromise even within this fractious party. And that's why that'll be a very interesting thing if they do take control and have to produce legislation.
I mean, isn't one of the questions here the division between the personal interests of Republican candidates trying to get elected and the message this says to them, which I think, David, you're absolutely right. It's against deal making, against compromise. And yet the national leadership is always going to have to try to reflect the interests of the party nationally and to be thinking of the presidency, one hopes, for their sake. And so then that's some kind of clash that you've set up, right?
Yes. This is a pretty narrow, an earthquake moment, but the fundamentals of that you describe and of the House are basically where they were. One thing that's interesting, though, is that remember after the government shutdown, John Boehner basically slapped back the elites that say they represent the Tea Party and the grassroots movement and said, basically, you've been tricking the grassroots and stop it because you're just doing it to raise money. And what that did was give Republicans who are not associated with the Tea Party and who might vote for comprehensive immigration reform a little breathing room, because it suggested that they weren't going to be primaried and have a bunch of money dumped into their district by the Club for Growth or the Heritage Action Fund because Boehner had slapped those groups back. What's dangerous about this result is that those groups weren't involved. Bratt didn't have the support of all the groups that are now claiming that they were on his side. He was off by himself, which suggests that it was a purely grassroots uprising. And that's even more dangerous because you don't see that coming. And so if you're a lawmaker, you're nervous, even more nervous than you were before.
But, John, that's why I don't understand how you get to this relatively optimistic or at least not entirely pessimistic position whereby you say, okay, the leadership is going to be not that much more conservative, and if they have a Senate majority, they're going to have to govern. But at every single election that comes, there does seem to be this greater and greater risk. First of all, you literally have lost one person who is a known, you know, known to make compromises and replaced him. That district is now replaced by someone who isn't. So that's a small thing. But the larger thing is the message that it sent is that no one is safe. If you're in a district where there are strong conservative primary voters, you have to play a certain way. And to me, that means the margin of error is disappearing.
Well, yes and no. If you're Lindsey Graham, who's in a state where John McCain's basically his presidential chances were interred there for a long time because of his support for immigration reform. Lindsey Graham's name is on the immigration legislation, and he won by almost 60% of the vote in his primary. So it's not true that this – and, you know, Mitch McConnell won in his primary and Cornyn won in his, and you can survive in the party if you have positions that the grassroots don't like. But you have to do a lot of things, and you have to do more than you used to keep yourself alive. And there are still some facts that you can't get over, which is that they don't have the votes to replace McCarthy, and they don't have the votes to replace Boehner, they being the most kind of conservative members of the House. And if you don't have the votes and don't have a person to replace them, it just can't happen. That's why they couldn't
but
replace
But can they
Newt
shape
Gingrich
the legislation,
right,
John, by scaring the people on the margins,
yeah,
who
well,
might have...
That's the problem. And then what you'll get into a position is they will try and scare the people on the margin, and they will scare a lot of them. But then you will have the counter pressure, which is... This is imagining if the Republicans take control of both houses, the counterpressure will be, wait, you said you want to be a governing party. Your national approval rating for the party is in the teens. And now you've got control of both houses and you can't get a single piece of legislation passed because you're so bollocksed up by your own internal warfare. That the weight of that will be a countervailing pressure to the fears people have about primaries, and then the individual, they're going to have to work it out.
Yeah, I guess I just think if you go back again to the individual versus the party incentive, that when you think of the demographic map and the redrawing of congressional lines, there's more and more incentive for the personal considerations to win out. And then, so they won't win the presidency. So maybe as a whole, they'll lose the Senate, but they'll keep their safe seats.
And the irony is that you end up with the situation that David Bratt says he fears, which is this executive acting autonomously and dictatorially. Why does the executive end up acting that way? Because there's a Congress that can't act, so that the Tea Party is producing the very outcome that it claims to be terrified of.
Although also maybe it has to get worse before it can get better. I mean, maybe crack-ups are good because we haven't looked over the cliff yet, and that's what it's going to take to pull the country back.
Heightening the contradictions.
The
you're right, Emily. I mean, if you can do it one of two ways. You either find a charismatic figure who whips everybody into shape, or the thing completely collapses. And, you know, there are political scientists who believe that basically that's the only way the rejiggering is going to happen, is when there is a – and that's both the rejiggering within the Republican Party, but also to end the kind of constipation of our national governing process, is to have some big crack-up.
All right, let's end
the – default on the debt.
Let's end that constipation now. Coming up, the Silicon Valley-backed campaign to destroy tenure for public school teachers. You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, and this is the political GabFest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic. A Superior Court judge in Los Angeles ruled this week that teacher tenure provisions in California are unconstitutional because they deprive students, particularly poor and minority students, of a decent public education. Tenure, said the judge, keeps unqualified, abusive teachers in the classroom, which reduces educational performance and lifetime earnings for the children who are taught by them. The case was brought and backed by Silicon Valley money, but it's part of a kind of larger ed reform movement that's been supported by the president and his Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan. So, Emily, what is the legal foundation for the ruling?
The legal foundation is that California, like every state in the country, has a right to education in its constitution. And in California, there's been a fair amount of cases built over the years about how this is a fundamental right, and it means that students should have access to equal education. So the main thing this judge is arguing is that teacher tenure operates in a way that is especially disadvantaging for poor and minority students because the worst teachers tend to work in schools with large populations of poor students. And so this is very much an attack on the particular model of teacher tenure in California, which I have to say is completely preposterous the way they've constructed it. But it's framed as a matter of equality and really as like a civil rights issue.
Were you persuaded by the legal reasoning?
Well, I'm sort of torn. I find the teacher tenure system in California to be crazy and awful. So my biggest problem with it is that they were tenuring teachers in the spring of their second year, which means really you only have about a year and a half of data to go by. That's before most states. The average time for teacher tenure in the states is 3 years. I would argue it should be even longer. And there just is good research that you don't know after a year and change whether you have a good or a terrible teacher on your hands. And the other thing is California in its statute has last in, first out, which means that seniority dictates everything about who gets to be hired and fired, or I guess especially fired. And that also, I think, is totally crazy to me. And there's an amazing statistic in the opinion that it can cost between $50,000 and $450,000 to get rid of a bad teacher. So all of that just seems like terrible, sclerotic policy for schools. And yet the notion that it is up to a judge to dismantle all of this in the name of making schools better seems suspect to me. Our colleague, our sometimes colleague Dana Goldstein, wrote a great piece for The Atlantic in which she pointed out that when you look at why schools with lots of poor kids are so bad, it is true that there are a disproportionate number of poor teachers at these schools, but it's also true that it's really hard to hire good teachers and that principals have trouble hiring. The teachers offered big incentives to work in these schools. Even teachers from urban districts often choose not to. The questions about what's wrong with these schools are much harder than just getting rid of teacher tenure. And so I'm not sure it's up to a judge to take this kind of step.
Two questions, Emily. One is, do you feel that way more broadly about judges? Basically, judges shouldn't be doing this, whether it's about education or other kinds of public policy.
Yeah, it's classic activist judging in that sense, where you're sort of taking this abstract concept of equality and then applying it in this broad way. I'd be really surprised if this ruling survives the California Supreme Court.
But and then the other question is, can't the judge say this is crazy and you go fix it? I mean, in other words, isn't that limiting what the judge is? Judges just trying to give lawmakers more or school boards more or school districts more flexibility, right? Not telling them what they should do.
Right. Well, this judge stayed his own ruling, so there's no practical effect. But he was essentially striking down the statute in California that sets the terms for teacher tenure, and that would invite the legislature to come up with a new and better statute. And maybe they should. I'm just, again, it just seems like a way of channeling a lot of frustration about education in this direction against bad teachers. And I completely agree that it's too hard to fire bad teachers. And I've watched family members who work in schools have an enormous amount of trouble with that. So it's very real to me. But I just don't think that as bad as they can be, the challenges are bigger. And what we really need to be doing is improving the quality of teaching across the board, because most teachers are fair to good. And they're there because they want things to be better for students. And the problem is their jobs are incredibly low status, not particularly well paid, and not constructed in a way that leads to a lot of quality professional development.
Right. There is this sense that teacher unions as a whole are this force for evil, and that tenure as a whole is a force for evil. What's the force for evil is that there are bad teachers who rot minds. But teachers' unions, every great school system across the world has teachers' unions. Every great school system across the world, I believe, has tenure. You know, every great school system across the world has protections for teachers being fired. That has basically nothing to do with the quality of the teachers. What has to do with the quality of the teachers is this profession honored? Are the working conditions good? Are you given decent compensation? Are you given high status in your society? And when we attack teachers' union, it pushes down status.
Right, but isn't something that teachers' unions support, just because something the teachers' union supports gets knocked down in court, doesn't necessarily mean it's an attack on teachers. In other words, the president and the Department of Education, they're not huge fans of the teachers' unions, but they want them to stick around. Yet they were applauding this ruling. So I think you can still think teachers' unions are useful and good, but that this is a bad policy that they support.
It's definitely a bad policy. Emily, as she laid it out, the California tenure rules seem terrible. But the emphasis that's been made on going after teacher privilege and teacher organizations, I feel, is misguided.
I think that's not the right
approach.
Can I pedantically go back to my point earlier, which is to say that you're right, tenure remains common. But since 2009, 2/3 of American states have weakened their teacher tenure laws in response to Race to the Top from the Obama administration. So there is this broader recognition that you can write these laws in a bad way. And when the unions are being smart, they recognize that and they allow for more flexibility of firing. It's just that then they also ask for these other things we're talking about that support the development of the profession in a positive direction.
So, Emily, last word on this. You don't think this has any legal life left in it. You think the California Supreme Court will strike it down. But do you think as a political or theme in the culture, is tenure going to go away?
I think tenure is going to weaken. And I think putting it off, postponing it, you know, 3 or 4 years down the road in a teacher's career is a really good idea. There's a trade-off here, though, which is that job security is one thing teachers trade for having higher salaries. And so if we're going to make their jobs less attractive by making them easier to fire, then we're probably going to have to pay them more, which, you know, there's been this whole push for merit pay, but one of the things Dana writes about in her new book is that there's just no evidence that that really pans out into better teaching or even that teachers exactly want to be incentivized in that way. So, you know, this is the problem that we're talking about, really. It's that this whole profession, which is maybe the most important job in our children's lives, is incredibly undervalued. I mean, I you know, if my kids wanted to become teachers, I have to say that as much as I honor the profession, I would be worried about them and what their futures were going to be like.
Wow. That is quite a thing.
Don't you feel
that
way?
No.
I actually, yeah, no, I don't either.
But
I
honor your feeling.
They would do it because they loved it and found meaning in it, which is should be the first principle anyway. And so if they've got that, I would be pretty psyched for them.
Yeah, but their likelihood of feeling beaten down and underappreciated and underpaid is going to be really high.
Well, that's true.
That'll do it for the political GabFest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of the show with more topics at slate.com/podcasts. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The Culture GabFest starts right now.
This is GabFest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Slate Culture GabFest, Obvious Child is the new indie movie about a young woman who decides not to bring her pregnancy to term. Then, adults are buying so-called YA or young adult books in droves. Should we be embarrassed to read books designed and marketed to kids? And finally, home ec was once the bane of feminism. Could it now be its silver bullet? Joining me today is Slate's deputy editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve. You're back.
I'm so re-Stevening you as I speak.
We've been re-Stevened. Yay.
You look re-Stevened. you're Slate's deputy editor, and your name's Julia Turner. I said that, didn't I?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, my God. I'm so good at this still. And Dana Stevens is the film critic of Slate. Do you feel re-Stevened?
Fully re-Stevened.
Did it take being re-Stevened to know what un-Stevened or de-Stevened feels like, or did you sense it while you were, was it a ghostly morning while you were experiencing it?
Stop fishing, Steve. We missed you. We're glad you're back.
Move it along. Let's do a show. All right, moving on. Obvious Child is a new indie movie from writer-director Gillian Robespierre. It stars Jenny Slate of Saturday Night Live as a young Brooklyn stand-up who discovers she's pregnant from a one-night stand and decides to have an abortion. Why don't we listen to a clip from the movie?
Hi, Ryan. I don't know if you're getting my messages, but I really would need to talk. Hey. Sorry, I didn't hear the... I don't care about the beep. I am also sorry that you cannot get to the phone.
All right, well, Dana, I just saw this movie. I haven't read a single review, including yours, but I'm very interested to know what you thought of it. What did you think of Obvious Child?
I'm a fan of this movie and of Jenny Slate. I was surprised by this movie because it had so much advanced publicity because of the subject matter. I had suspected that it would be something much more incendiary. I mean, I think that it's possible that its effects in the culture will be incendiary, but the movie itself surprised me by its kind of mildness and sweetness. It's a pretty unassuming little comedy that doesn't take on any real political stance.
Mm-hmm. But don't you think that that itself is where the political weight of the movie is felt, that it didn't go in for large crossfire-like topical discussions, and in fact was matter-of-fact about the fact of abortion, which is why it's going to be, in some quarters, incendiary.
I wonder if it will. I said in my review, I think this is going to reverberate like a shot across our national conversation about abortion. That has not happened in the week that it's been open, but it is opening across limited markets rather slowly. I think parts of the country, more red states, have probably not seen this movie yet, so mm-hmm. we have yet to see how it will land in those states. But you're right. What's shocking, if anything, about this movie is how casual it is about the young woman, Donna Stern, the character that Jenny Slate plays, her choice to get an abortion. We never even see her make the decision, actually. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's not any scene of hand-wringing or brow-furrowing or consulting with her friends or family about whether to do it. It's a foregone conclusion that she's going to do it, and the questions become, is she going to tell the guy that got her pregnant about it? And, you know, other questions that have to do with the surrounding circumstances of the abortion, not whether to get one or not.
Right. When to get it, how to get it, whether to get it on Valentine's Day or her mom's birthday, which are her two choices. But there's not any ambiguity about whether this is the right choice for her in her life.
Okay, so Julia, we'll dig into whether that makes this a more political or less political movie on and on. But setting aside the topicality of it, it's not a topical movie overwhelmingly. It seems to me it's a slice of life and beautifully felt movie. Did you like it as a film?
Well, I loved some of the performances in it, and particularly Jenny Slate's. And I should caveat here that Jenny Slate went to high school with me, was in my sister's class, and I know her a little bit. I haven't talked to her in years. But I was really, really impressed with her performance, which I thought showed incredible comedic range, which you may expect from her if you've seen her various bit parts around the comedy sphere since she sort of flamed out on Saturday Night Live. But I actually felt that the politics of the movie rendered it somewhat dramatically inert. Like, the whole point of the movie seems very consciously to be a corrective, to make a movie about the fact that having an abortion is no big deal for a certain set of women in a certain place. And as a result, when she goes out to have the abortion, she faces no conflict. There's no inner conflict about whether to have it. When she talks to the people in her lives about it, they're unfailingly supportive. Did you not find that it was slightly dramatically inert that everywhere she goes in the whole movie, she's greeted with support and open arms and like, yay, abortion? I mean, I get politically why that movie needs to exist because of so many other movies like Knocked Up, where it's just a foregone conclusion that this woman for whom an abortion would completely make sense isn't even considering having an abortion, or Juno, where this, I think, more finely drawn character makes a specific decision to carry the baby to term and give it up for adoption rather than have an abortion. But still, I'm glad this movie exists, and yet I felt that its political rectitude became a dramatic weakness.
I'm going to disagree with you because I don't think the movie is principally about her having the abortion, which is what I loved about it and what surprised me about it the most. I think it's about a woman of enormous potential and wit and charm whose life is not cohering and coming together for her in her late 20s. And at that moment, she gets pregnant, and some women might be tempted to anchor or center their life in having the baby. And for her, that's not an option. So it's not only this decorous decision not to build a movie out of topical flashpoints that attracted me to it. It was the depth of feeling around the predicament that this woman's life appears to be in general, beyond the specific fact of this pregnancy and what she's capable of building or not building out of her life. And then the possible, I love the sort of tentative and possible romance at the heart of the movie between this preppy guy who doesn't, superficially at least, you would think maybe doesn't quite get who she is or what she's about, and what they might build out of this decision not to have the baby. I thought all of that was handled so beautifully and so gently that it didn't make the movie feel inert to me. It made it feel true.
I can see Julia's critique of inertia, dramatic inertia in this movie, but I might have maybe wanted to place some of that tension elsewhere. I agree that this movie could have benefited from more tension, more character development, and a little bit more time. I mean, it's a very short movie, 83 minutes long, and it leaves a lot of things, interestingly, kind of delicately in suspension at the end. I don't think they all have to be tied up, but I thought that the relationship with this preppy guy who gets her accidentally pregnant, played by Jake Lacy, who's really terrific in the part, I think, could have been developed a little bit more. Whether or not he agreed with her decision or was supportive of it, there could have been a little bit more trouble and tension between the two of them, because without giving away what happens in the course of the movie, the way that she reveals to him that she's pregnant in the end is kind of problematic. It's something that you can imagine someone being very upset about, finding something so important out in the way that she tells him, right? And she's this kind of compulsively confessional stand-up comic who can't sort of help revealing things that she didn't necessarily mean to reveal. And I would have liked if that, just plot-wise, got her in a little bit more trouble that she had to find her way out of. I had this feeling I don't often have at the end of a movie of, is that all there is? I could use another 20 minutes.
I would definitely recommend that people see it. I mean, it's refreshing to see this particular political take on abortion, this apolitically political take. And enough of this movie is very funny and charming that it's just worth seeing for its own sake.
All right, the movie's Obvious Child. It's directed by and written by Gillian Robespierre, starring Jenny Slate. Go check it out and tell us what you thought of it. Coming up, are adults too adult for young adult literature? You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf, along with Julia Turner and Dana Stevens, and this is the Culture Gabfest portion of the show. If you'd like to find links for the things that we mention on the program, well, we collect them for you on our show page, wnyc.org/ @GabFest. And please, while you're there, leave a comment. Tell us what you think of us. That's wnyc.org/GabFest. All right, on to our next topic. All right, well, moving on. Readers of Margaret Talbot's engaging New Yorker profile of the YA novelist John Green, he who wrote the novel The Fault in Our Stars, whose movie adaptation is now conquering the box office, may have found their attention snagged on the following sentence, as I did. Margaret Talbot writes, "The stripped-down cover also meant that adults could read it on the subway without embarrassment." She goes on to say, "Adults have become big consumers of YA fiction, and the numbers back this up. It turns out it's quite a big trend. A whopping 28% of all YA sales are to readers between the ages of 30 and 44. So someone had to do it, and she did. The critic Ruth Graham threw down the gauntlet in Slate, saying, "Adults should feel embarrassed about reading literature written for children." Julia, I think when we were deciding to do this topic, you said that you read YA fiction. I'm curious if you do, what you read from among it, and are you embarrassed?
I'm not embarrassed, and I found this article published in Slate thoroughly unpersuasive. I thought it was not a convincing case that anyone should be ashamed of reading adult fiction. I just want to parse her argument a little bit. She argued in Slate primarily that young adult fiction offers the reader pleasure instead of ambiguity and moral complexity and some of the other pleasures that are more traditionally associated with fiction written for adults. I think it's very apt to suggest that there's different kinds of reading that one can do as a reader, and that sometimes one goes to literature for complexity, moral ambiguity, the mystery of the human character, the mystery of what to do with your life and how to feel about it. But to argue point blank that a fiction written for adults is good at that sort of thing and that fiction written for young people is bad is a very broad stroke that strikes me as completely inaccurate. I mean, think about all the direct written for adults. So it just seemed like a blanket assignation of values to adult fiction and fiction for kids that seemed totally wrong.
Mm-hmm. Dana, what about you? Did this argument have any traction with you at all?
Well, you know, I follow this argument much more closely than I usually follow, I don't know, dust-ups on Twitter about who should read what. I mean, this is exactly the kind of thing that usually I ignore because I feel like that's not a worthwhile debate. And yet I just felt like the things that people were bringing to this conversation were so interesting. I couldn't stop reading and thinking about it. I think everything in me seems like it would have been aligned to agree with Ruth Graham. I like her as a critic. I don't read a lot of young adult fiction myself. I'm literature PhD. But yet I found myself viscerally turned off by her argument just because of the shame factor, because of the high degree of importance that she gave to the feeling of shame and embarrassment about what you read. So that even though, you know, the people that were popping up saying, "How dare you, I'm going to read whatever I want," may have been, in fact, aligning themselves with literature that I consider less interesting, I completely agreed with them. And I agreed with the tweet of Laura Miller's, the Salon book critic, who said something about people should be ashamed of telling other people to be ashamed of what they read.
Mm-hmm. Seems to me the cranky apocalyptic argument comes in two related versions. The first is a literary panic, right, which is the taste for serious writing is drying up or being replaced by a taste for the pseudo-literate, the immature, or the easy. And then the second is what A.O. Scott has called the cultural devaluation of maturity, that increasingly adults are assuming worldviews appropriate to teenagers as a way of avoiding complexity and ambiguity that life, forget literature as a category, life itself presses upon human beings. And when they can't cope with it or aren't given by the media or whatever, their parents or the schooling system, the equipment to deal with it, they'll revert to these safe aesthetic cocoons like YA fiction. Do I believe either one of those arguments? I actually think it's even more complicated than that. What I would say is that certain kinds of normative ideals of maturity require that people give up a part of their personality as they supposedly, quote unquote, grow up. And those very parts of their personality are the, you know, questioning, the unformed, the supersensitive that we associate with adolescence now, in part because we don't have a way of carrying that degree of searchingness into our adult self, in part because I think our pop culture is degradingly cynical about that part of our personality. And let's face it, most of us in the adult world in a capitalistic structure, you know, have to take on a bureaucratic self or a productive self that isn't allowed to think about ultimate ends. So it makes perfect sense to me that in some ways the best part of us is attracted to literature that is about young people who have yet to be absorbed into either that cynicism or that bureaucratic grayness. So in some sense, I'm overwhelmingly
heartened by the trend to read these kinds of books. On the other hand, I become worried because the flip side of that is that once people do become a settled and mature self, they're very, very, very hard to market to. And I do think A.O. Scott is right to say that there's a general tendency in the culture to keep people unformed or unsure, I mean really insecure about who they are, as long as possible in order to keep that demographic marketing category that when I was a kid was called 18 to 34. I mean, you aged out of it at 34. And as I age, literally that category follows me. Then it was 18 to 49. You could market certain things to people up to the age of 49, after which it was just simply impossible. They just weren't motile enough or whatever. I swear to God, that category is going to follow me to the grave, and I don't want it to. So I see both sides of this in some sense.
Yeah, but I think you're talking about two different things here, Steve, and that there's ambiguity in this too, right? So on the one hand, to be connected with your inner searcher self, your inquisitive self, your observational self, your self who is constantly appraising your relationship to the world around you, that sort of feels like a very teenage thing to do, a very alive thing to do, a very almost transcendentalist, Emersonian, Thoreauian way to live, right? Which maybe we think of as a good thing. I'm more inclined to believe that side of the argument than the notion that that just makes us, brand shiftable prey for marketers. Like, I think it's exciting to connect mentally with that time in life if you're not there anymore. And I also think children are confronted with darkness, ambiguity, and the scariness of life in all sorts of literature, all forms of literature, at various ages. And I think if you can find literature of all sorts, whether it's a board book or a YA novel or a fantasy series or a detective novel or an actual piece of proper literary fiction put out by Knopf and anointed by the right people, you should embrace that wherever you can find it. And I also don't think it makes you a bad person or a lesser reader to sometimes pull up a mystery novel or read something that isn't going to subvert your notion of how you fit into the world. It's just like a good yarn. I think that's okay.
Well done, group. All right. The essay is in Slate.com. It's by Ruth Graham. It's called Against YA, Read Whatever You Want, But You Should Feel Embarrassed When You're Reading What Was Written for Children.
Oh, I won't. I shan't.
All right. Moving on. Home economics classes in which you learn to sew a button, boil an egg, used to be a staple of high school and college curricula. Back in the dark ages known as the 1970s, the second wave feminists came in and killed off home ec for being a means of yoking women to demeaning work and thereby second class status in the industrial economy. Seems perfectly reasonable. However, Rebecca Traister argues in The New Republic that we are now a post-industrial economy, and home economics may be one means of making domestic work, cooking, cleaning, raising kids, managing a household, more gender neutral. Julia, it seems to me that this is, at least on its face, a pretty plausible argument. What did you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, so I grew up in the way post-home ec era. It wasn't that there were like home ec classes that weren't mandatory that I was taking. It was that home ec appeared only in like young adult fiction from the 70s that I was still reading in the 80s. And I remember always being kind of jealous. Like, home ec sounded kind of cool and fun, and you like made potholders or something. I don't know. It was like elusive, a near miss in my past. Like, it felt like I could have had home ec if only. This article seemed plausible for the first half of it, and then went on to make a series of wild claims about what reintroducing home economics could do for the American populace, its beleaguered men. I think it ends up by arguing that it will teach the beleaguered young men of America how to like love and feel again. That seemed somewhat beyond the ken of home economics as I understood it from reading Judy Blume. But in general, I think there's a tension in American education from kindergarten through professional school between focusing on ideas and cultivating the mind and focusing on practical skills, right? I mean, you hear this, like, architects graduate from architecture school, but they don't actually learn how to design a building till they apprentice with a real architecture shop afterwards. Lawyers graduate from law school, and then they have to take the whole summer after law school cramming for the bar, which is what actually introduces them to the statutes of the land that they will have to finally parse in their careers as lawyers. And to me, home economics sort of falls into the same category. There's a set of life skills, how to, you know, manage a budget, sure, how to boil an egg, that depending on what household you come from, you might not pick up, that it seems like it would be useful if primary and secondary education could impart. And I think we can take as a given that it would be imparted in modern times in a gender neutral way and might be useful, might be an interesting break in the routine of the day for students. It seemed like a worthy suggestion to me.
I mean, I think Rebecca Traister is exactly right that education in general should have more focus on life skills. I think there should be a college class on managing your life, a class on paying bills and paying your rent and dealing with all kinds of bureaucracies, you know, the stuff that your parents do when you're a kid and then you find yourself out in the world and don't know how to do it. But there are so many things that should be offered in schools. I mean, I think reading this piece, I mainly just felt the sort of sadness about this pie-in-the-sky vision of education. Of course, we should have more opportunities to do things like home ec in schools. We should also have recess and art, right? And and anything except test prep for some sort of standardized test. But it just it didn't seem like there was a very practical proposition being laid down.
Right. Well, I had mixed feelings about the article. On the one hand, I think that one of the central points that she makes cannot be made often enough, that an ideological framework was shattered in the 1970s by which, you know, men automatically enter the sphere of serious breadwinning and women automatically become homemakers. So all hail the first and second wave feminists for doing that. Nonetheless, a social practice persists that even as women graduate from college in greater numbers than men and their breadwinning statistics catch up to men's breadwinning statistics, the housework is still sloughed off on women. This is what the sociologist Arlie Hochschild has called the second shift. It's a very real phenomenon. It's getting a lot of press. It needs to get more press. So I was happy to see that it was in this article, reiterated in this article from a new point of view. I think you still have to take into consideration the instability of inputs and outputs when you're dealing with presumably you're talking about teaching this to adolescents or tweens or slightly post-adolescent kids. You're basically teaching it to, you know, the YA age group at some point. And there is a kind of volatility between inputs and outputs. And if you don't call it the right thing and present it the right way, you're going to massively reinforce the very gender identities that you're looking to transcend or at least soften. So I would, first of all, I wouldn't call it home ec. Second of all, I would call it something, I mean, every
extreme life skills with a Z.
What's wrong with home ec? Just that it's old sounding?
It's just, it's as creaky and old as you and I are, Dana. And it's just going to make, but also I do think it's a relic of a super gendered past. And so to the extent that anyone has any association with it, it's going to be a negative one. And it's going to, for right or wrong, it's going to hit the ears of certain boys as feminizing and vaguely Maoist because of that, like top-down and Maoist.
So what's your euphemistic substitute?
Call it life hacking or, I mean, you know, give it some ridiculous...
Best roommate ever, bro.
Anyway, so bro up the name a little bit. But then, Julia, I think you're onto something when you say that we're at an interesting crisis point in the history of American education, especially public education, which is, you know, post-World War II, we invested nobly in the idea that every child has a full potential, that it is their American patrimony to try to achieve. And that's a wonderful ideal. We also tried to hide from ourselves that those are wildly disparate in many cases. And at a certain point in the educational trajectory of a kid, you have something like, you always keep it provisional, but something like a sense of what that's going to be. And in denial of that fact, we've de-stressed vocational education, practical education, and we've tried to treat everyone more or less the same. And then we rush in super sophisticated education or, you know, really demanding education at the later stages at university and especially at the postgraduate level in this country, and then shunt people off on, you know, on shop and home ec in this vaguely humiliating way. Teaching these as universal life skills seems to me actually a kind of a dignified way of rectifying that.
Yeah, and I like your notion of calling it life hacking, which just feels sort of modern and feels accurate. There was actually a really interesting editorial in the Huffington Post that suggested that classes like this might be particularly useful around food because people are eating so much packaged food, and packaged food tends to be so much less healthy than preparing food for yourselves. And, you know, in general, I think figuring out how to cook and, like, you know, nurture yourself and, like, not die seemed like part of the original home ec mission. But a class that sort of taught you the basics of nutrition along with some other life skills seems totally useful. I still, of all the facts I learned in all my whatever 17 odd years of education, one of them was imparted to me by Mr. Keith Hills Pallant, who was my math teacher. I think it was like Algebra 1 or something like that, but we were learning about exponents. And so we learned about compound interest. And he said in that class the minute that you have the opportunity to start saving for your retirement, do. And he did, like, you know, 10 minutes of, if you put in 1,000 here, you get X by the time you're 60. And if you wait 10 years, you get Y. And it just stayed with me, you know, like just having someone present it as, this is not just a series of numerals and equations on a board. What we're studying applies to how you will go on to manage your life as a, you know, person in the world. That really stuck with me. And I think we could stand to connect education, all sorts of education, with more useful life skills.
All right. Well, the article in the New Republic was called Feminists Killed Home Ec. Now They Should Bring It Back for Boys and Girls. It's by Rebecca Traister. Check it out. All right. Well, now is the moment in our podcast where we endorse. Dana, what do you got?
This is the second week in a row that I'm going to endorse something that was on Slate. So after this, I promise to go non-Slate endorsements for a few weeks. This week, I'm going to endorse a long reported piece by Rachel Neuver about dollhouse dioramas. You saw this, right, Julia?
Yeah.
It's fantastic. This is one of the best things I've seen on Slate in a while. So it's the story of this woman named Frances Glessner Lee, who in the 40s and 50s was a homemaker, a frustrated homemaker who was obsessed with forensic science and legal questions and crime, and who eventually sort of clawed her way, without really any education in this area, into being one of the foremost experts on forensic science and really changed the practice of forensic science by making these dollhouse dioramas of crime scenes that were uncannily accurate. And there's also a great slideshow of these dollhouse dioramas. So they would be miniatures of the place where some crime had occurred, with every detail perfectly in place, the body exactly where it was. She would age the fixtures so that they actually looked like, you know, a house that was of that age. And they're really beautiful to look at. And it's a fascinating story about both about, you know, feminism and about this woman's sort of rise to prominence in this emerging field. And also, if you are interested in miniatures and, you know, sort of recreations or crime scenes, it's fantastic on that level, too. So just take a look at it for yourself and you'll see what I mean. It's called Murder in Miniature. It's by Rachel Neuver and it's on Slate.
Cool. All right, Julia, what do you got?
So we did not talk. One thing we did not talk about when we discussed Obvious Child is the name. The name of the movie is drawn from a Paul Simon song from the album Rhythm of the Saints. And somewhat amusingly, the one-night stand scene, which is very flirtatious and involves a lot of frantic half-naked dancing, is scored to this wonderful Paul Simon song. So my endorsement for this week is the semi-forgotten Paul Simon album Rhythm of the Saints. I think it was the album that came out after Graceland. So the album after the album that put him at cocktail parties across the land and made him like the soundtrack of liberal America. You know, it wasn't like quite as catchy. It didn't catch on in quite the same massive way that Graceland did. There was no obvious, like, You Can Call Me Al follow-up song, but there are incredible songs on that album. It is so worth putting back into your rotation. That particular song, it was fun to encounter again, but a bunch of the songs on that album are truly stellar. So Paul Simon, Rhythm of the Saints.
All right. Well, this week I'm going to endorse two related books. The first is simply the biography of, I think it's become the standard biography of Van Gogh. It's by Stephen, I'll probably mispronounce his name, Nefe, and Gregory White Smith. I haven't finished it, but I was vaguely familiar with all of the things that all of us know about Van Gogh. He sold only one painting in his life. He was kind of considered an oddity. He didn't really fit in anywhere he was. He was mentally afflicted in ways that have never been definitively diagnosed. He had a friendship with Paul Gauguin. And he sliced off his ear. I didn't know anything more. I have to tell you, even though it's a massive book, even though I'm only about 20 to 30% of the way through it, it's utterly fascinating to read. I mean, he only lived until he was in his, at the latest, his late 30s, I believe. He died in his late 30s, possibly early 40s, but I think it was more his late 30s. He's 24 years old. He hasn't picked up a paintbrush yet. I mean, he's so lost. He's so the archetype of the annoying, self-centered, melancholic young man who believes that he's uniquely connected to the universe, except in this case, he's right. He's Van Gogh. I know how it ends. You paint the most beautiful canvases anyone ever created. Some of the most unique and beautiful artworks will flow from your hand. I mean, it's so moving because he's so close to being not only a non-entity, but the annoying twerp that everyone in his large Dutch family mistakes him to be, except for Theo, of course, with whom he develops this beautiful sibling relationship.
His brother, and correspondence. Right. Unbelievable correspondence.
Well, as the biographers rightly say, one of the truly great documents of the human experience. I mean, so anyway, and of course you know how it really, really ends, which it turns out that the portrait of Dr. Gachet, which Van Gogh paints, I believe, in the week before he dies, becomes the single most valuable object ever by market standards ever created by a human hand in 1990 when it sold for $82.5 million. So part of the Van Gogh story is this afterlife, right, of total vindication at the hands of both critics, audiences, and, of course, the art market. That story is beautifully told by a woman named Cynthia Saltzman in a book called The Portrait of Dr. Gachet, the story of a Van Gogh masterpiece, Money, Politics, Collectors, Greed, and Loss, which basically tells the entire afterlife of Van Gogh via this painting, this portrait of Dr. Gachet, and how it falls into various hands. It's bought for, you know, pennies, basically, several times over. It ends up, and of course, it's also the story of the gathering strength of Van Gogh's reputation over time, which is itself a remarkable story, how he went from, you know, and it wasn't quick. 20 years out, you could have bought Van Gogh's collected works for pocket change as many as 10, 15, 20 years after he died. It was really beginning in the early 20th century. And even then, they were not very highly prized. It ended up in the possession of Goebbels. I mean, the whole story of the painting is really, truly remarkable. And it is really the second biography of Vincent Van Gogh, his posthumous biography. And so the two taken together are remarkable. I highly recommend it.
Those sound amazing.
Thank you, Dana.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Julia.
It's nice to have you back, Steve.
It's very good to be back. You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's program at wnyc.org/gabfest, where you can also leave a comment. And you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, or the WNYC iPhone app. Just search for Slate Gabfest. Gabfest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Ann Hepperman and Mike Vuolo. Our interns are Max Tanney and Anna Schechtman. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For everyone on the Gabfest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf. We'll talk to you next week. Well, I'm accustomed to a smooth ride. Oh, maybe I'm a dog who's lost his pride. I don't expect to be treated like a fool no more. I don't expect to sleep through the night. So people say lies, lies, lies. But I say why? Why deny the obvious chime?